Case Closed, Crime Stories from the Golden Age of Radio. Welcome to Case Closed, your weekly hour of old-time radio crime stories brought to you by RelicRadio.com. We'll hear first today from Philo Vance, episode from that series titled The Left-Handed Murder Case. That one aired January 10th, 1950. And it's 5-Minute Mystery and Alibi in Red. We'll finish off with Whitehall 1212 and the Murder of Nora Brady, episode that aired August 3rd, 1952.
All right, dear. Now, everything's all right. Take it easy, darling. What happened? Did you have a bad dream?
It wasn't a dream, Mother. It wasn't a dream. I saw him. He was at my bedroom window.
Steve?
Yes, I couldn't sleep. I haven't been able to sleep since we broke up. And then I saw his face at the window. Mother, it was awful.
Oh, I know, darling, I know. I'll call the police. Even if you were married to Steve, he has no right to do this to you.
Well, the police won't be able to help us. They'll say I dreamt it. And Steve will deny he was here. The police have been trying to get something on him for months. You know that.
We'll talk about it in the morning. Your father hasn't come home from his meeting yet. I'll leave a note for him in our room, and I'll stay with you tonight. How will that be?
Well, I'll feel much better then, Mom. I'll be sure one thing at least. Steve won't try to kill me. Tonight.
She's sleeping now, David, but she was restless all night. What do you think we ought to do?
I don't know, but I'm going to do something, I'll tell you that.
Eat your breakfast, David.
I don't want any breakfast. I want to do something to make sure Steve doesn't bother Jan again. And I'm going to do it.
I told Jan last night, and I'll tell you now, David. The police will take care of him.
When? After he kills Jan and makes a nervous wreck of her? Oh, no, Helen. He isn't going to get the chance. I'm going to see to that myself.
Red Queen and a Black King, Steve.
I know. I see it.
Okay, okay. I thought maybe you missed it. Why does a guy play solitaire anyhow?
One reason, Lefty, is that it gives him something to do when he's alone with a mug like you.
Oh, I'm a mug, huh? Well, look, Steve, maybe I ain't such a mug as you think. Maybe I ain't as stupid as you think, either.
You'd go broke betting on that, Lefty.
Oh, yeah?
That's what I like, intellectual conversation.
Steve, the boys and I have been talking.
I can't imagine anything duller than that.
Wait a minute. You don't know what we've been talking about.
Did you?
Sure. Boys and I think maybe you're losing your touch. They think maybe you ought to step down and let me run the gang. With you sticking around to plan the jobs, like always.
Now, look, Lefty.
Hey, boys, take your hands off my collar. You're bending the suit.
I'll bend your neck in a minute. Now, get this, Lefty, and see that the boys here are too. I'm head man in this outfit, and I'm going to stay that way until I decide to quit.
That's the way it is.
That's the way it is. I'll quit when I'm ready and not before.
Okay. Maybe the boys won't like that. Maybe they got their own ideas of how you're going to quit, Steve.
The singing private investigator. I didn't know you crooned.
I didn't know you were typing the lyrics of a song, Ellen.
Oh, I'm not. I'm writing up the details of your last investigation, the tip-top murder case. And singing helps me type.
If you ever want to get your typing finished, I'd suggest you sing something a little faster.
Now, you didn't come out of your private office just to increase my musical tempo, did you, Vance?
No, I just wondered if the district attorney had called before I came in this morning.
Nope. No word from Mr. Markham. If there had been, I'd have told you.
I thought perhaps you might have been too busy trying to remember the last line of the lyrics of that song you were singing.
Vance, nobody has to worry about a last line of anything when you're around. Oh, yes? Is there something I can do for you?
Not unless you're Philo Vance.
I'm Vance. What is it?
Oh, hello, Vance. I'm Steve Cayley. I want to talk to you. Can we go into your private office?
Come on. I don't want to be disturbed for a few minutes, Ellen.
Right, Vance.
Come in and sit down, Cayley.
Thanks. You've heard of me, Vance?
Never, in a very complimentary fashion.
That was good for my business.
Was good?
That's right. I want to quit. I want to quit while I'm ahead and I'm healthy. I want to leave the gang I've been running around with.
As I understand it, you were the boss. How will the boys feel about your walking out?
Not good. That's what I want you for, Vance. Figure out a way I can get out with my skin in one piece, and I'll take care of you.
Sorry, that's out of my line.
Not interested in making a buck, huh, Vance?
Not the way you suggested. Besides, seems to me I read something about you and your divorce a month or so back. Your wife claimed you were a pretty nasty character.
I was the same character when she married me. I got a little news for you. I'm a little worried about her. And about her old man and her mother. They all hate me pretty much.
Apparently, not without reason. Sorry, Cayley, you've come to the wrong man. If you want to quit your gang, why don't you give yourself up to the police? They'd gladly keep you away from your boys for 5 or 10 years, as I understand it.
I'm allergic to cells, Vance. I'll tell you what I'd like to do, though. Suppose I give you the dope on the boys. What jobs they've done, all that. Think we could make a deal?
Wait a minute.
Yes?
See if you can get me District Attorney Markham, Ellen.
Right.
Ringing the DA in on a deal, huh, Vance?
Yes. You want to give evidence against the boys you've been working with, and he's in that business.
Okay, anything you say. All I want to do...
Just a minute, Cayley. Yes?
Mr. Markham isn't in his office, Vance, but I left word for him to call you.
Thank you.
Well, Vance?
Mr. Markham isn't in. I'll tell you what you do, Cayley. Sometime between now and this evening, Markham will call me back, and I'll set up a date for 6 o'clock in his office. You stay with me until then.
That's all I gotta do. I'll meet you up there, Vance.
I'd rather you were where I can keep an eye on you.
Yeah, I know. I'll see you at Markham's office. Unless...
Unless what?
Unless one of my friends sees me first.
Your friend is late, Vance.
Steve Cayley isn't my friend, Markham. I doubt whether he's anybody's friend. But you're right about one thing. He is late. He was supposed to meet me here in your office at 6. It's 6:20 now.
Maybe he got cold feet.
He seemed to be worried about the rest of him being cold in the event he met one of his enemies. But I don't...
Excuse me.
Of course.
District Attorney Markham speaking.
Hello, Markham. This is Douglas in Homicide. Are you busy?
A little. I'm here in my office with Philo Vance.
Well, how would you like to come up and look at a brand new murder victim?
Oh, it's hardly my idea of fun, Douglas. What's happened?
We've got a corpse up here at 300 Rosland Drive. I think maybe you ought to come up.
I will, as soon as I get through here. Vance and I are waiting for a man named Steve Cayley, and after he arrives, I'll meet you up there.
You're waiting for Steve Cayley, huh? Well, Markham, you're liable to have a long wait. The corpse I was telling you about once answered to the name of Steve Cayley.
Me, Mother.
Oh, hello, dear. You're late coming home. Stop off somewhere?
Yes.
Where?
Don't bother me.
David!
I'm sorry, Mother. I didn't mean that. Where's Jan?
I don't know. She's out, too. I thought she might have stopped by at your office for you.
She might have. I wasn't there.
Where were you?
Nowhere. Just walking. And deciding what to do about Steve Cayley.
You mustn't do anything about him, David. He's caused us so much trouble already. Don't make things any worse. Promise me you won't.
All right, Mother. But it's a little late for me to be promising anything where Steve Cayley is concerned.
All right, you guys. All right, dry up. Shut up, I said.
Okay, Lefty, you don't have to get sore.
I don't want nobody to tell me what I have to do.
Okay.
I got something to say to you guys, and I'm going to say it very quick. Steve Cayley is through. He's finished. His nerve is shot. He's going to pack us in. Maybe he's going to turn us in. But we got to do something about that.
I ain't doubting you, Lefty, but How do you know about it?
I just come from his place.
Oh, yeah. What?
Now, listen. You guys gonna listen to me? Hey,
sure, Lefty, we'll listen, but what do we do about Steve?
I'll take care of that. I just want you guys to know what's up. Are you with me?
Sure.
Okay, so you know how we feel. Lefty, now, who does the job on Steve?
Well, I just wanted to find out how you guys felt before I broke this to you. Any of you guys has to worry about knocking off Steve. That's been taken care of already.
There he is, Markham. Steve Cayley. Somebody did a nice, clean job on him with that knife, right?
Yes, Chuggles, that's right. Well, Vance, you see anything that might help us up here in this apartment?
Perhaps. Cayley was killed when the knife was plunged into his heart. The knife went in at an angle, and the hilt of the knife is nearer his right shoulder than his left.
That means something, Vance?
Does to me, Douglas. Markham, let's you and I go back to your office after you call Kelly's ex-wife to have her meet us there.
All right, but why?
Kelly was killed by someone who was left-handed. It's the only reason for the knife to be slanted the way it is. A right-handed person would have had to practically break his wrist to get the knife in the position it's in now.
Yeah, I see what you mean. But why call Kaylee's ex-wife down, Vance?
I know he was having trouble with her, as well as with several other people, Markham. We might as well start with her.
Start what with her?
Finding out whether she's left-handed, of course.
Miss Clark, you're using your maiden name now, of course.
Yes, Mr. Markham.
Miss Clark, your ex-husband was killed by a person we believe to be left-handed. Are you left-handed by any chance?
Not that I know of.
Any questions, Vance?
Miss Clark, what glove do you put on first?
Why, the left one, I guess. Doesn't everyone?
I do, Vance.
So do most right-handed people. You had reason to kill your ex-husband, of course, Miss Clark. He told me that himself.
Well, many people have reason for killing others, Vance. It's a good thing for civilization that that isn't the only thing one needs to murder.
You have a point, of course.
You can't question our child without our being here.
Daddy,
you can't.
Mother.
It's all right, dear. We had to come. We followed you from the house after you received that telephone call. What are you trying to do to our child?
I'm District Attorney Markham, Mrs. Clark. Mr. Vance and I were just...
You were just trying to make it look like she killed Steve, weren't you?
Now, take
it
easy.
Well, she should have, but she didn't. And don't you try to make it look like she did.
Mr. Clark, we're not trying to make anything appear different than it actually is. You seem awfully sure she didn't do it.
Do you think she did?
Everyone is a suspect until we get some definite information, Mrs. Clark.
She didn't kill Cayley. She couldn't have killed him.
No, Mrs. Clark. Why not?
Because I did. Mother!
Don't believe her. She had nothing to do with his death. I killed him. I killed him myself.
Did you, Mr. Clark? How?
How? Well, I shot him.
How did you kill him, Mrs. Clark?
I shot him. He was tormenting my daughter. I shot him. You've got to believe I did it.
Are either of you left-handed?
No.
I'm not. And what difference does it make? I shot him, I tell you.
I know that's what you tell me, Mr. Clark, but Steve Cayley wasn't shot. He was stabbed to death.
What?
Yes, I suggest the three of you go home now and stop trying to alibi for each other. Good night. And what a night. This is District Attorney Markham. The left-handed murder case opened with the killing of gang boss Steve Cayley. Philo Vance is sure a left-handed killer did the job. And our suspects include Cayley's ex-wife, Jan Clark, and her father and mother, although none of them admits to being left-handed. The parents each confess to having killed Cayley, but we're convinced they're merely trying to divert suspicion from their daughter. Vance, remembering that Cayley had mentioned one of his gang named Lefty, has gone to find that individual, and I imagine...
Look, Lefty, you sure you got this thing figured out right?
Sure. Sure, I'm sure. Look, you see that traffic light?
Well?
It's got to turn red, ain't it? And when it turns red, a car's got to stop, don't it?
Sure.
Well, there ain't much traffic up here. When a classy car pulls up to stop for the light, you get up on one side of it, I get on the other. We conk the driver, we take the car. We need a classy car for the big job I got in mind.
Okay, if you say so. I don't argue with my new boss.
So he's the new boss, eh? That means he's Lefty.
Who are you?
My name is Vance. I followed the two of you up here.
You did? Why?
Steve Cayley mentioned you when he came to see me just before he was killed. He told me where I could find you. I went there just in time to see you leaving, so I followed you.
So you found us. Hooray.
Lefty, I'm taking you down to see District Attorney Markham. We've got some questions to ask you. We think...
Will you... I figure you don't like questions, Lefty. That's the reason I conked him with my gun.
You practically broke his skull. Good for him. Leave him here. Let's beat it fast. Things are starting to get a little complicated.
You're finding out what a lot of guys find out, Lefty.
Huh?
It ain't so easy to be a boss.
Vance's office, Miss Deering speaking.
Ellen, this is Markham.
The district attorney. I give up. I did it. You got me, partner.
Ellen, this is serious. Something's happened to Vance.
No.
I've just got the report. A man was picked up on the corner of Fort Wade Drive an hour ago and rushed to the Mercy Hospital.
What?
He'd been hit on the head.
What makes you think it's Vance?
The description and identifying cards in his pocket. I'm positive it's Vance, Ellen. I'm on my way up there right now.
So am I. Thanks for calling me. I'll get there right away.
I'll meet you there. I'd like to get my hands on whoever it was that hit Vance. Believe me, I would.
You'd like to get your hands on him. I'd like to get my nails in him. I'll meet you at the hospital in 20 minutes.
Two hours from now, Jan, and all this unhappiness will be over. We'll be on our way to the coast, and we'll stay away until you've forgotten this unpleasantness.
Oh, thanks, Dad. You and Mother are being swell.
Oh, which reminds me. Mother, how's the packing coming?
Just a few more things, Dad, and I'll be ready to call you in to help me close the valise.
Good enough. Jan, I wish you wouldn't be so nervous. It's all over. Steve's out of the way for good.
I know, but I can't help what I'm thinking. Dad, did you kill Steve?
We won't talk about Steve. We decided that.
Well, Mother said you were late coming home. You're never late coming home.
I said
home.
We won't talk about that. Why don't you go see if you can help your mother pack?
Packing's all done, and the valises are closed. What's going on between you two?
Nothing.
Nothing at all, Mother. Well, it looks like we're all set to leave here, doesn't it?
Well, I think that perhaps we ought to let the district attorney's office know we're going out of town.
What for?
Well, they may not like it.
Who cares what they like? We're not criminals. We can come and go where and when we choose. The sooner we get out of here, the better.
David.
Yes?
You said we're not criminals and we can come and go as we like. But are you sure one of us isn't a criminal? A criminal who just hasn't been caught up with yet? How does your head feel now, Vance?
Not good enough to listen to you do a chorus of Sally in our alley, I'll tell you that. Nice of you to come up, Ellen. You too, Markham.
We're certainly sorry to see you in this hospital, Vance.
I assure you, it's much more comfortable lying here than it was on the street corner. Though if the truth is known, I don't remember much about lying on that corner.
Take my word for it, the pavement was hard.
Take my word for it, that smack on my head was harder. You sent anybody out to get this Lefty person, Markham?
I sent Douglas. He's Sergeant Heath's best man, Vance. He'll bring him in, don't worry. And I'm very anxious to talk to him for two reasons. One of them is the fact that he's responsible for your being in the hospital, and the other is that name of his, Lefty.
I know what you're thinking, Markham. Lefty and a left-handed murderer. Is that it?
With the motive he has, yes. But supposing it turns out not to be Lefty, Vance?
I have an idea.
Please let it have something to do with me for a change.
It has. You are going to leave here.
Me and my big mouth.
What do you want me to do, Vance?
Get the Clark family up here, Markham. Father, mother, and daughter. I want to see them all in this room.
Suspects can come up, but I've got to go. What's the use of being honest?
You can stay, Ellen. I was only teasing.
Oh.
Markham, you get the Clarks here and see that the heat in this room is turned on as high as it will go. What? I'll try and solve this case from a hospital bed.
Vance, you've said an awful lot of things that have confused me on an awful lot of occasions, but that last statement of yours makes me wonder just how hard you did get hit on your head.
Worried, Markham?
Yes, I am.
You do as I ask, and you aren't the one who should be worried about me, my friend. It should be either mother, father, or daughter, Clark.
Look, Callahan, I want to do this myself. That door to Lefty's room is awful thin. I can bust it down by crashing into it just once, I'm sure. And Sergeant Heath says I'm to bring Lefty in, so I'm gonna do it. Okay?
Right.
Okay, here goes. Step back and keep your gun ready.
Hey, what's going on out there?
Hey,
who's that?
Hi. Okay, you hold it. Hold still, don't move. Oh, there's two of you, huh?
A cop, eh? What do you want busting in here like this, fella? You got a warrant?
No, Lefty, but I got a gun.
All right, don't
do me
shoot,
a favor
shoot.
And try
All
to
right,
argue with it, will you? Come on in here, Callahan. We got two passengers for the wagon. Isn't that nice? We'll have company all the way down to headquarters.
It's terribly warm in this hospital room, Vance. Are you sure you're comfortable?
Yes, Miss Clark, but thank you for being so solicitous. I hope Mr. Markham's call didn't interfere with your plans.
Didn't interfere? Of course it did. We were leaving town. It probably made us miss our train.
The last I heard, there were other trains.
Your information is still correct, Ellen. Mrs. Clark, if somebody threatened the safety, perhaps even the sanity of your daughter, you'd take steps to prevent that from happening, wouldn't you?
Of course I would.
And so would I, Vance.
I'm sure you would, Mr. Clark. And I'm sure that Steve Cayley was a constant threat to your daughter.
Look, we've already confessed to killing Steve. But neither you nor the district attorney would believe us.
Of course we wouldn't. You both said you shot him and Cayley was stabbed. Vance, we're not getting anywhere.
I imagine that's so. Oh, all right. The Clarks can leave if they like, Markham. I guess a case can't be solved from a hospital bed after all.
I'll help you out with your coat, Miss Clark.
Thank you. I'll be ready for it in a second, as soon as I find my gloves.
I'll help you look for them.
Well, they're not under the bed.
Well, I'm sure they were on this chair. I remember putting them right there on top of my coat. Here they are. They must have fallen on the floor.
Well, we still might be able to make the train if we leave right now. Goodbye, Mr. Vance. I'd like to shake hands with you and wish you a speedy recovery.
Thank you, Mrs. Clark. Well, Mr. Clark, you want to shake hands with me?
No.
I will. No hard feelings, Mr. Vance. Pardon my glove.
That's quite all right, Miss Clark. Where's your other glove?
Right here in my hand. Why?
I just wanted to be sure you had it. Because I'm very sure we have you as Steve Cayley's murderer. It's very hard to explain why Miss Clark is our murderer, Markham. A combination of everybody talking and the way my head hurts makes it very difficult.
All right. Quiet, everybody, please. Quiet. Go ahead, Vance.
Well, to begin with, Cayley was killed by a left-handed person. Miss Clark had denied she was left-handed because she realized the mistake she made when she left the knife in Cayley's body at a revealing angle.
Our daughter is left-handed, yes, but she's not a murderer.
Why didn't you tell her she was left-handed?
Nobody asked her.
That's right, Markham. When Mr. and Mrs. Clark came into your office to confess, we didn't mention the fact that Cayley was killed by somebody who was left-handed.
Weren't you too brilliant, though? All right, so I'm left-handed. I put my right glove on first, so you knew that when I shook hands with you. And I did kill Steve. Do you know anybody who deserved death more?
I'm not prepared to say. All I know is that if you had waited a while, I'm sure one of his own gang would have done the job for you. Markham, if you don't mind.
Not at all. All right, everybody, let's leave Vance alone now.
Not exactly alone. I'm staying.
All right, Ellen.
Let's go, everybody. Mr. and Mrs. Clark, and of course, Jan.
Come along.
Goodbye, Vance.
Thanks, Vance. Thanks for everything.
Well, I guess that's that, Vance. How do you feel?
Not too badly, thank you, Ellen. By the way, you know why I wanted this hospital room heated.
I know now. You wanted to make sure the Clarks would take off their coats and their gloves.
That's right. I stalled for a while with unimportant talk to make sure the heat of the room would get them to take off their coats and gloves by themselves, without any suggestion from me that might put them on their guard.
You mean put Jan on her guard, don't you?
I didn't know which of the Clarks was guilty, Ellen. In fact, I didn't know if any of them were. I had to make sure one of them showed they were left-handed before I could do anything at all.
You did plenty, Vance. If you don't believe me, ask Jan Clark. But getting back to Markham's office a minute, what was all that confessing business up there?
Mr. and Mrs. Clark wanted to keep suspicion off their daughter, even though they didn't know at the time that she had killed Kelly.
Oh.
Chances are she tried to get them to murder her ex-husband, making up stories about how Kelly was annoying her. Well, I guess they didn't act quickly enough to suit her.
Uh-huh. By the way, you know, of course, that it could have been Kelly's gang stooge, Lefty, who knocked off the big boss.
It might have been Lefty, of course, but not in view of what happened here a little while ago.
You mean Jan's confession?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you've got something there. And I guess Markham will be able to get plenty on Lefty and the rest of Kelly's gang.
No question about that. Well, as they say in books, this all came out fine in the end.
In the end and at the end of the left-handed murder case.
Another 5-minute mystery.
Sheriff, just one more question and my interview will be finished.
Okay, that paper of yours certainly wants to know everything.
What one thing in particular do you think is responsible for your excellent record in solving crimes?
Observation. Keen observation.
Uh-huh.
You can pick up a wealth of information from hearing and remembering seemingly unimportant things. I remember one time... Excuse me.
Sure.
Sheriff Crowley speaking. Yeah? Suicide? Ada Bell Fredericks? I'll be there in 5 minutes.
I'm right with you, Sheriff. This is more than the paper bargained for. Shouldn't there be powder burns around the wound, Sheriff, if this is suicide?
Should be. That's why this is no suicide. It's murder.
Murder?
That's right. And I'd like to know where you two fit into the picture. I thought Miss Ada had always lived alone.
Well, I'm Mabel Foster, the old dame's niece. She asked me to come live with her 3 weeks ago as sort of a companion, I guess you'd call it.
Aunt Ada had very strange tastes in her choice of companions.
I'm just as good as you are, you money-grabbing
break
Beethoven.
Break it up. Where do you fit in?
I'm Paul Westcott, a nephew. I came here 3 days ago to discuss some business arrangements at Aunt Ada's suggestion.
What business arrangements?
She was changing her will.
Yeah. Now I gotta share half and half with this chiseler.
I'm afraid you won't be sharing in any of it now, cousin. Murderers don't inherit.
Say, what are you insinuating? I was in the kitchen putting nail polish on my fingers when I heard the shot.
You have a nice manicure job there, Miss Foster. You know, I always smear mine, having the patience to wait 5 minutes for them to dry, I guess.
Who's this female character?
A reporter. Go on.
Well, I was just finishing my left hand when Paul left.
Where'd you go?
I went out the side door to the garage, and I couldn't have shot Aunt Ada from the garage.
But I didn't kill her either. I didn't have any reason.
Seems to me you had plenty of reason, Miss Foster. Both of you.
Cousin Mabel probably wouldn't wait for me to leave. She was just fooling around with her nails waiting. I wasn't out of the house more than 3 minutes when I heard the shot. Mabel probably ran in the bedroom, got Aunt Ada's gun from the dresser drawer, and shot her.
Now I know who murdered old Ada Fredericks, and it wasn't Mabel. It was you, Paul Westcott.
Do you know how the sheriff trapped Paul, even though he claimed to be in the garage at the time of the shooting? Well, in just one moment, we'll hear, but first... Thank you. now, back to our mystery.
You had to be the killer, Paul. Instead of going to the garage, you opened and slammed the door to make Mabel believe you'd gone. Then you tiptoed back into the room and shot your aunt. Mabel couldn't have fired the shot because, as the reporter here said, Mabel's fingers have an unusually nice polish job. Any married man would know that a woman sits around for at least 5 minutes waving her hands in the air so her polish will dry. But you admitted seeing her put the polish on less than 3 minutes before the shot was fired. Mabel couldn't have grabbed the gun out of the dresser and fired it. If she had, her polish would be smeared.
Well, that's what I'd call having an alibi at the tip of your fingers.
This is Scotland Yard.
For the first time in its history, Scotland Yard opens its official files to bring you the true stories of some of its most celebrated and baffling cases.
These are the true stories. The plain, unvarnished facts, just as they occurred, reenacted for you by an all-British cast. Only the names have, for obvious reasons, been changed. The broadcasts are presented with full cooperation of Scotland Yard.
Research for Whitehall 1212 comes from Percy Hoskins, chief crime reporter of the London Daily Express. The stories for radio are written and directed by Willis Cooper. Now you are to hear the voice of the man in charge of Scotland Yard's famous Black Museum, Chief Superintendent John Davidson.
The things we have on display in the Black Museum are mementos of crime. Murder is the most frequent category. Here among the knives, the guns, the bludgeons, among the vials of poisons and the ropes and cords that have served as murder weapons, is this incongruous object. I'm sure you know what it is. Yes, it's a shoe, the kind known in Britain as a Wellington boot. It's an old-fashioned thing invented by the Duke of Wellington himself. You've seen Wellington boots before. The tragic thing about this one is its small size. It was worn by a 10-year-old child. Here is Chief Inspector John Mackey Marsh of the CID, who will tell you about Scotland Yard case number 343-1198.
This is the story of a person who was twice tried for the same murder. In fact, I think this is the only instance of that in the whole history of British jurisprudence. I'll tell you more about it. On the afternoon of the 5th December 1937, in Newark in Nottinghamshire, a little 10-year-old child left her schoolroom for her home a short distance away. That was the last time she was ever seen alive, except by a few persons who did not recognize her. Her name was Nora Brady. She was the daughter of Jack William Brady, a coal carter, and Maggie Summers Brady, his wife. At about 10 that night, when Nora had not returned to her home, the police were notified and inquiries begun. During the night, the following procedures were set in motion.
All the other pupils in the school attended by Nora Brady were interviewed at home, most of them already abed.
Results, nil.
All the relatives of the Bradys in Newark were interviewed.
Results, nil.
All traffic on the Great North Road, which runs through Newark, was screened.
Results, nil.
Every piece of abandoned and derelict property in a wide radius of Newark was examined.
Results, the child was not found.
The fruitless inquiries continued all through the night. In the morning, all Newark school principals were asked by the police to inquire of their pupils whether any of them had seen Nora Brady on the previous evening.
Results, one principal reported to me that one of his pupils had seen her. When, I asked.
Between 4:30 and 4:45 yesterday afternoon, he tells me.
Where?
Opposite the bus station, he tells me.
You are sure he recognized her?
He says he did, sir.
Was she alone?
He says not.
Ah. Who was with her then?
He's quite positive.
Who?
A former lodger of her father's. A man known to him as Nora's Uncle Ted.
Is he her uncle?
No, I do not believe so.
I'll ask Brady.
A little later in the day, when the news of Nora Brady's disappearance had got around the town of Newark, a Mrs. Black came forward.
I didn't see the little girl, Chief Inspector, but I did see a man waiting near the Wesleyan school she attended.
When?
At about 4:45 yesterday afternoon, about 15 minutes before school was dismissed.
What was he doing?
Just staring at the door of the school, as if he were waiting for someone.
Who was he, do you know?
Yes, sir, as a matter of fact, I do. I live next door but one to the Bradys. I was the lodger they used to have, the one they threw out, the one that Nora used to call Uncle Ted.
And the driver of a bus that runs between Newark and Redford, a small town about 25 miles away.
He said he remembered a child with a slovenly middle-aged man on the bus that left Newark at 4:45. He did not know the child, but his description of her clothes corresponded with the dress and coat she was known to have been wearing. But we couldn't find Nora Brady. I told her father, Jack William Brady.
No, Ted Peters ain't her uncle, sir. He's no relation to any of us. And besides, I threw him out of my house. I didn't want him about.
Why?
Well, for one thing, sir, he drinks.
Oh, great. Many people drink, Mr. Brady.
And I enjoy a pint myself after a hard day's work. But I'll have no man lying about my house 40% of the time in a drunken stupor and making a beast of himself.
Anything else, Mr. Brady?
I should really well say there was anything else. My wife's sister in Sheffield, she and her husband, they introduced Ted Peters to us as a friend of the family. Friend of the family, indeed. He had an old broken-down motor car that he used to drive about in. That's how great a friend of the family he was. My wife's sister's husband, my brother-in-law, Bert Stickley, he know this Ted Peters in the RAMC, in the war, so that makes him a friend of the family.
And what else?
And that's just it, I'm trying to tell you. We let him have a room, turning it into a blinking pigsty he did, never having a bath and sleeping in bed with his boots on and keeping scraps of greasy fish and chips and God knows what else lying about till the very roaches themselves wouldn't eat them. And pinching my shorts and using violent, filthy language before my wife and poor little Nora. I chucked him out.
And what did he say to that?
He swore something fearful till I broke two of his ugly teeth for him. And then he slunk away muttering most horrible curses and threatening me how he'd get even with me.
Oh, he threatened you?
And besides, he never paid me one single farthing of the shillings a week he owed me all that time.
How long?
15 ruddy weeks. 6 times 15, 90 shillings, £4.10 he owed me altogether for rent alone. And my wife and me had to take a bleeding shovel and clean out that pigsty he'd made of our room. He went away muttering and cursing and threatening us. Is he a relation? My aunt's cat's left hind leg he is. It's Ted Peters stole my little Nora. You get her back and at once too, or I'll do it. And I'll bring you back Ted Peters' thinking head in a bucket besides.
Did he ever threaten your daughter, Mr. Brady?
Little Nora? No, he never threatened her. It was me that he...
He didn't threaten her?
He said something to me about taking the most precious thing I had. Well, I thought it was just talk at first, but he knowed how much I thought about Nora. And besides, he seemed to have a kind of a fascination for her. He was always bringing her bits of toffee or cakes or something. He was very good to Nora. Once he gave her a 1/2 crown, but I made her give it back.
The child loved him.
How can a child love a pig?
What's this Uncle Ted business?
She had some idea that he was connected with my wife's sister and her husband that introduced this Ted Peters to us.
I see. I think. Do this brother and sister see Ted Peters at all now?
She's mixed up on some kind of deal with him. She's got money of her own a little. She's talking to him, she says, about raising the money for him to buy a lorry and go into business. I don't know what kind of dirty business he's gone into. Or he wouldn't let him touch the coal that I haul. He'd get it dirty. Go and make him let my kid go.
Does Peters live in Redford?
Redford?
The driver of a Redford bus says he saw a man with Nora yesterday.
Lives at Hilton? That's on the road to Redford. That's where he's got Nora. You go there and see.
I went to Hilton, but I didn't see what Brady had expected me to see. Ted Peters did live in Hilton, and... an infinitesimal village not far from the River Idle, which is a part of the network of waterways that lies about nearby Sherwood Forest. Sheffield, where the elder Brady's sister-in-law and her husband lived, is some 50 miles away by most baffling roads. I found Peter's house, which was ingenuously named Peace Haven, at 7:45 of a windy, rainy winter night. The house was dark, but Peter's lit a lamp and we sat down to talk. I spoke first. When did you last see Nora Brady, Mr. Peters?
Who's Nora Brady?
You don't know.
She's sick?
You do know.
Oh, she's that kid of Brady's and you, where I used to live. Oh, I know who she is.
When did you see her last?
About 15, 16 months ago.
Oh?
Hmm.
You didn't see her yesterday?
Well...
Is that what you're saying to me?
Well, I saw 15, 16 months ago, sir.
There are people who will testify under oath that they saw you with her yesterday. Yesterday.
Oh, yesterday.
She has not been seen since yesterday.
Wonder where she is.
You don't know?
How on earth would I know? How would I know?
Has Nora been here since yesterday?
I told you, it's been 15, 16 months ago.
Will you answer my question? Has Nora Brady been in this place since yesterday afternoon?
No.
Would you mind if searched this house?
You won't find it.
In addition to searching the house, I'll have to search the grounds too, you know. I shall dig up everything.
You won't find her here.
Where is she?
I don't know.
But she has been here.
I don't know where she is now.
But she was here.
Well, she wanted to come.
Why?
Well, yesterday when I was waiting for the bus at Newark...
What were you doing in Newark?
I was expecting to meet Brady's sister-in-law.
She lives in Sheffield.
You know, I thought she might be visiting in Newark, visiting the Brady's.
She wasn't, though, was she? Why did you want to meet her?
Well, she's going to get me some money to buy me lorry.
Ah, I've heard about it. But she wasn't there, we know that. You didn't visit the Brady's to see if she was there, though, did you?
Of course not. Brady hates me.
Did you ever threaten Brady?
Well, I was indignant when he chucked me out.
I know about that, too, Peters. All about it, including your threat.
Well, then what are you asking me about it for?
I'm reminding you that I know.
Brady lies.
Brady's daughter has been kidnapped. That's not a lie.
Are you going to listen to me?
With great attention, I assure you. Go on, sir.
I was waiting for the bus when this comes up. What's your name?
You know her name, Peters.
All right. She says to me, Uncle Ted, she says she always calls me Uncle Ted. Are you going to see my Aunt Bernice? That's her father's sister-in-law that lives in Sheffield.
What made her think you were going to see her?
She's a talk offense. Well, I says, your aunt's coming to see me.
About the money for the lorry.
Exactly what I told her, Governor.
Get on with it.
Well, then, Uncle Ted.
She always called you Uncle Ted.
Uncle Ted, she says, take me with you so as I can get to see the baby.
What baby?
The sister-in-law's got a new baby, 3 or 4 months old. She carries with her wherever she goes, you see. And that's the baby this mother wanted to visit. So she asked me to fetch her back here, where this lady from Sheffield and the baby was going to be, and... You all consented.
You consented? This was at the bus station?
Yes, at the bus station.
What were you doing at Nora's school at 3:45?
Huh? Oh, she asked me to meet her.
Then you did bring her here?
Yes.
Where is she?
I'll have to tell you about that.
I'm afraid you will.
This morning...
What time?
About 9:30. About 9:30, there's a telephone call for me.
Where?
Oh, at a house down the road where they let me use their telephone. I haven't got a telephone.
Whose house?
Mrs. Lester's, Mrs. Kate Lester's. You could ask her.
I shall.
Well, it's from this little aunt, and she says she couldn't come today. She couldn't come for another week, and yeah, it was the little Nora that wanted to see the baby.
What did you do then?
Well, I told Nora first, and then I told her she must go.
Back home?
Well, I told her she wanted to see the baby, so I gave her an half a crown and started her off for Sheffield to see the baby. Well, what's wrong with that?
You didn't call her parents and tell them?
No. She was going to see her aunt, wasn't she?
So you say?
I gave her half a crown.
Is half a crown enough to get her to Sheffield?
She'd have to walk a good deal of the way. Then there's the bus.
You... mean to say that you sent a 10-year-old child out in this weather to walk?
Why not?
What time is this?
About noon.
When it was raining hard, when half a gale was blowing.
Well, that's why I don't know where she is. She might have got lost.
You didn't telephone her parents?
Oh, her old man would have... Where are you going, sir? Don't you want to hear any more? Don't you want to find her?
No, I don't want to hear any more. Yes, I want to find her. That's why I'm going out and check up on what you've said. You stay right here. I shall want to talk with you when I return.
Where would I go, Governor?
I don't know where you'd go, my man. Because there's one of my constables standing outside this door in the rain. You'll certainly not get very far. I spoke to Mrs. Kate Lester, the owner of the telephone, down the road. Yes, she knew Ted Peters. He was a frequent user of her telephone. Yes, Mr. Peters had talked on her telephone about 9:30 that morning. Yes, she'd overheard him, although Mrs. Lester agreed it's not neighborly to eavesdrop. It was with someone in Sheffield, Mrs. Lester said. Peters seemed to be cancelling an appointment he had had for that same day with someone in Sheffield, which apparently had to do with borrowing money to buy a lorry. Mr. Peters had decided against buying the lorry, he had said, and the person in Sheffield would not need to come and see him at all. And did he mention the name of Nora Brady, I asked Mrs. Lester? Or say anything about a baby? No, said Mrs. Lester. It was all about lorries and not coming to see him any more, and that was also. And when I returned to the Peacehaven cottage, Ted Peters was gone. The light was still on. Nothing appeared to have been taken. The constable at the front door had heard nothing, but Ted Peters was gone. We searched the place from roof to cellar. An extraordinarily filthy place, quite consonant with the tales we'd heard of Peters. There were indications that a child had been there, perhaps even whilst I'd been conferring with Peters. A school notebook, half filled with undecipherable childish scribblings, apparently quite recently done. A child's grubby handkerchief stamped in indelible ink with an N. A half cup of cold cocoa. But of the child, no other sign. And of Peters, nothing. He returned at 2:10 in the morning, his boots muddy and his outer clothing wet. I called for more constables, and by lantern light we went over every inn of the surrounding fields while Peters watched us silently with no expression at all on his face. At 7:00 I charged him with the kidnapping of Nora Brady under the Offences to the Person Act. Nora Brady was never seen alive again by anybody. Peters was tried at the Warwick Winter Assizes of Birmingham and was sentenced by Mr. Justice Armour to 7 years penal servitude. I shall not forget what the judge said to him as he passed sentence.
Ted Peters, you have been, most properly in my opinion, convicted by the jury of a dreadful crime. What you did to that little girl, what became of her, only you know. It may be that time will reveal the dreadful secret which you carry in your heart.
And Nora Brady was never again seen alive by anyone. I had thought I would never have to look on Ted Peters again either. But I saw him again. I had seen him last in the dead of the worst winter England had had in 17 years. The next time was in balmy midsummer weather, in the following June. I have spoken before of the honeycomb of waterways that lies about the Sherwood Forest country. The River Idle is one of the principal of these streams. It flows slowly and peacefully north to the Trent. But near Hayton, where Ted Peters had his home, Peacehaven, there is a short stretch of water called Bolam Shuttle, deep, swift, and unpleasant, a part of the River Idle. On Sunday the 6th, June 1937, exactly 5 months and 1 day after Nora Brady had disappeared from the schoolroom, I was informed that a Donald Palmer, of whom I'd never heard, wished to speak to me on the telephone. I answered, Chief Inspector Marsh here.
Hello, Chief Inspector. Donald Palmer speaking to you from Bottery in Nottinghamshire.
I'm afraid I don't know where Bottery is. Do I know you, Mr. Palmer?
I'm manager of the gasworks at Bottery, Chief Inspector.
Yes?
Bottery is on the River Idle, Chief Inspector.
Yes?
Only a short distance below the town of Hayton.
Hayton? What's happened now at Hayton?
It's not at Hayton, sir. It's Bottery, below Hayton, on the River Idle.
Yes?
I remember you when that man Ted Peters was arrested.
Yes?
I thought you might be interested in what I have discovered in the river here, sir.
What have you discovered, sir?
A dead body, Chief Inspector.
A dead body?
Yes.
A dead...
The dead body of a child. A girl about 10 years old.
I was off post-haste to Bawtry. I will not tell you how I got there because I don't remember, and I can conceive anyway a few others who would have reason to go there. But there we were. Palmer, the gasworks manager, Henry Bernard, the great pathologist from the Home Office, a gaggle of country constables, me, a brace of newspaper detectives, assorted wives and sons of the gasworks men, and in an outhouse of a nearby country inn, the pathetic little body of the drowned girl. Yes, it was Nora Brady. Jack Brady, her father, had been summoned from Newark and made the tearful identification. He recognized the blue jumper dress she had worn and her brown cloth coat and the neat cotton underclothing her mother had made her. It was difficult to recognize her otherwise. Adipsia tissue, due to long immersion in the water, Henry Bernard said, had set in. But the identification was positive. It was Nora Brady, and she was dead. Only one person was missing, but we knew where he was. And the coroner's jury was convened. Henry Bernard, the pathologist, testified.
No, this child did not die from the effects of drowning. It is true that the body has been immersed in the water for a long time. It's not inconsistent, in my opinion, to say that she has been in the water for at least 5 months. That is to say, since early January of this year, but she was not drowned. I ask you to observe this mark around the neck. This was caused before death. She was strangled.
Could that not have been caused, sir, by the neck of her dress having caught on a low branch above the water?
And been suspended by the neck, I presume you mean, sir?
Yes, sir. That might...
In that case, the mark would have been flat and broad from the neckband of the dress. This one is sharply defined and it is cut into the flesh of the neck.
Yes, but...
And if the marks were caused by the dress supporting the weight of the body, the marks would have been oblique. You can make such an experiment yourself, sir, and find for yourself.
Well,
This mark is horizontal all the way around the neck. The child was strangled.
But
what?
Well, maybe that happened after she was dead.
There is no water in the lungs. I can demonstrate that to you.
Yes, sir.
And you have seen the marks on the tongue, the marks that correspond with the child's teeth where she bit her tongue. That is a characteristic of strangling or suffocation. They always bite their tongues.
Well, but...
She couldn't bite her tongue after she was dead, sir.
Oh.
The child was strangled.
There was more talk, but the evidence was incontrovertible.
Verdict of the coroner's jury...
We, the jury, find that the deceased came to her death through the agency of a person or persons unknown.
Now it was my turn again. I was myself morally certain that the person or persons were not entirely unknown. I could not help reflecting on Mr. Justice Armour's speech to Peters when he sentenced him.
What you did to that little girl, what became of her, only you know. It may be that time will reveal the dreadful secret.
But it's never well for a policeman to entertain prejudices. The hangman's shadow sometimes grows dim. However, I thought I might journey to the prison where Ted Peters was still serving his 7 years. But I was not sure. I was not sure. Then Henry Bernard, the pathologist, brought something into my desk and laid it down before me. I looked at it. It was damp and soggy. It was cracked and twisted. Obviously, it had been in the water a long time. I picked it up. What is it, I asked?
It's a Wellington boot, I should say. Wasn't that child wearing Wellington boots when she was last seen?
She was. I'll ask her father to look at this and see if he can identify it.
She wasn't wearing Wellington boots when that fellow found her body.
Wasn't she?
She had only her stockings on. All of her clothes, except her hat and her Wellington boots.
Where'd you get this?
Policeman found it.
Where?
In Bolam Shuttle.
Wait. My mind went back to that evening in January, when I left Peters alone to go out and check his story of a telephone call. When I came back, he was gone. Had he been to Balham Shuttle that cold, stormy night, carrying a body with him? A very small body. That had been hidden in that house until I left. A body that he must get rid of before we search the place. Would a body, I asked Bernard, float all the way from Balham Shuttle to the place where hers was found?
It could.
I remembered Peter's muddy clothes when he came back that night. Could you identify that mud if I found it, I asked Bernard.
If I had something to compare it with, yes.
Balham Shuttle.
Get me the mud you want to identify and I'll go down to Balham Shuttle and compare it myself.
The mud was on the clothing he was wearing that night last winter.
Did he wear those same clothes at his trial?
Yes. Yes, he did. I do remember.
He wore them to prison?
That I don't know.
If he did, they've still got them at the prison where he is.
Do you suppose... Of course they are. They don't wash prisoners' clothing, they give them new.
Well?
I'll get your sample.
Mail it to me. I'll be at Balham Shuttle.
I went to the prison where Peters was confined. I did not see him, though. My business was with the governor. I showed him sufficient cause, and he gave me Peter's muddy clothing. I posted them to Bernard and sat and waited. Finally, a telephone call was put through from Retford to me. It was a very short one.
It wasn't difficult. The mud's identical.
And then I went back to the prison and asked to see Ted Peters. To find that Peters had gone over the wall, escaped. I sat there when the governor told me, miserably clutching that kid-sized Wellington boot. The same one the chief superintendent John Davidson showed you. The one he has in the Black Museum. Oh, we'll find him, said the prison governor reassuringly. We'll find him. I walked out miserably, still clutching the shriveled boot. They did find him, though, a week later. Lurking one night in an abandoned shed near the place in Newark where Jack Brady was employed. He had a heavy rubber cosh, blackjack you'd call it, and a caliber 32 revolver loaded. He was charged by the police with a variety of crimes against the King's peace and lodged safely in the Newark jail. That's where I saw him a day later. Peters, I said, where were you that night last January when I left you alone in that house at Retford?
Peacehaven.
Peacehaven.
Well, I don't know.
You had Nora Brady in that house hidden all the time I was there.
I did, huh?
And you carried her to Balham Shuttle and killed her and dropped her body in the water.
You're alive.
She was found, strangled to death.
That was way downstream.
But we found this in Balham Shuttle.
What's that?
Nora Brady's shoe. One of the Wellington boots she was wearing that night.
She's not.
We can prove it is.
You can't prove I was at Balham Shuttle.
Oh, yes, we can, Peters.
The boot slipped off her foot and I'd have got it, but the water was so cold.
So cold for a little girl, Duke.
She didn't feel it.
Ted Peters, I arrest you on a charge of willful murder and I warn you that anything you say will be taken down in writing and may be used in evidence. And Ted Peters went to his second trial for the same murder. This time at the Nottinghamshire Assizes in the Shire Hall in the city of Nottingham, he was found guilty and sentenced to death. And this time, after the Court of Criminal Appeals had turned their thumbs down, he was hanged at Lincoln Prison.
Heard on Whitehall 1212 today, Horace Braham as Inspector Marsh. Others in the order of their appearance, Harvey Hayes, Winston Ross, Beulah Garrick, Gerard Burke, Carl Harbour, and Lester Fletcher. Lionel Rico speaking. Whitehall 1212 is written and directed by Willis Cooper. Somewhere right at this moment, somebody's home is on fire. If the people who live there are lucky, They've all escaped. The firemen have arrived, and maybe they've even rescued a few odds and ends. Yes, every 20 seconds through the year, a fire breaks out in the United States. These fires kill 11,000 persons each year, disfigure for life, or severely burn thousands more, and destroy $7 million worth of property. Protect your home from fire by following these simple safety precautions. Don't smoke in bed or throw away lighted cigarettes. Clean out closets, any place where old newspapers, magazines, and inflammable materials are liable to accumulate. Repair defective electric equipment and replace worn or frayed wiring. Use cleaning fluids that will not burn. Remember, don't gamble with fire. The odds are against you. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
That's Case Closed for this week. If you want to hear more old-time radio, just visit relicradio.com. You'll find past episodes from Case Closed, alongside all the other shows, like the horror, strange tales, Relic Radio thrillers, our sci-fi series, all kinds of stuff. Linked to right on the front page of relicradio.com. It's also links there to our forum, Facebook page, Shoutcast stream, and our donate button. If you'd like to help support this and all the shows, I certainly appreciate it if you're able to help out. Thank you very much to those who have, and thanks for joining me today. Be back next Wednesday with another hour of old-time radio on Case Closed.